Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
John Semley is a prolific journalist and cultural critic based in Toronto who regularly contributes to the Globe and Mail and Maclean's magazine. His obsession with comedy led him to fall in love with true originals in the innovative Canadian troupe, The Kids in the Hall. Here now is a clip from the classic Kids in the Hall sketch, Screw You, Taxpayer.
Wow, what a bad sketch. And in such poor taste, too. You know, we're going to get a lot of telephone calls and letters about this one. And why not? Because every Canadian has a right to complain about that sketch. Because every Canadian owns a piece of that sketch. You see, your tax dollars feed into the government, which in turn mandates the CBC, which in turn provides funding, both whole or in part, to shows such as ours. So, like a cupful of water poured into an ocean, the atomic particles of your tax dollars mix with the whole and wind up providing for the budget of the show, for the budget of that sketch, and for this piece I'm doing now, which we call...
Screw you, taxpayer!
Let's meet some of the other people behind the scenes. Hey, this is Peter Razmoski. He's sort of in charge of the props on the show. Peter, that was a really nice props that the guys had in that sketch.
Oh, yes. Even though I did not laugh at script and read-through, I had the prop made special.
Special? And how much would that cost?
$1,250. I could have got for less, but I thought, why should I bargain? It's not my money. Screw you, taxpayer!
Thanks, man. Scott? Yeah, come over here.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. You were featured pretty prominently in that sketch, weren't you?
Well, yes. Yeah. So sadly.
And you must get paid pretty well, don't you?
Well, Mark, what do you think this means, huh?
Anything you want to say for yourself?
Actually, yes. First of all, I'd like to say hello to all the taxpayers, and screw you. And second of all, I'd like to take a little bit of our national network airtime to advocate that I be allowed to masturbate in public buildings.
ECW Press has just published This is a Book About the Kids in the Hall, Semley's exhaustive and engaging overview of the life and times of Dave Foley, Bruce McCullough, Kevin MacDonald, Mark McKinney, and Scott Thompson, otherwise known as the Kids in the Hall. Semley and I recently met at his home to discuss his own trajectory as a fan and journalist, the smug and sincere world of comedy, the history of the Kids in the Hall, and much more. So, here we go. This is myself and John Semley talking about the Kids in the Hall on Creative Control. John, thank you for having me in your home.
Thanks for being in my home.
What is this place that we're in?
Bloorsdale, I was going to say. Bloordale.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, near Bloor Lansdowne.
Bloordale, is that what it's called?
That's what they, you know how they micro-compartmentalize neighborhoods in Toronto? This is the neighborhood where just as of yesterday, there was a toxic gas event.
I heard that. You couldn't go outside. There was a cloudy mist, and they were encouraging you to stay inside.
In Don DeLillo's White Noise, the toxic airborne event. But of course, I found out about this. Like, I got home and sort of checked my phone and Facebook, and all my friends are messaging me like, don't go outside, don't go outside.
Right.
It's like, oh, I've been walking around for 20 minutes.
Well, I don't understand how you find that out on your way home. Like, what are you supposed to think? You know, you're walking home.
Exactly. Well, I mean, I'm a bit south of it, so they got it all cleaned up.
Well, do you know what it was? I don't.
It was sulfuric mist.
Of course, it was sulfuric mist.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like the origin story of like a the Toxic Avenger, like the Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, you could
or something.
Be a superhero in the making. Right
oh
here.
God, that's all I need is that responsibility.
Well, it's nice to be here and to meet you. We've never met. I don't think.
Yeah, likewise.
We've probably been in the same rooms,
concerts, or
yeah. Did you go to the? I know you're a fan. Did you go to the Sharpling and Worcester show? At the
I
Monk
did.
Club? Yeah, I was there. I was at that thing.
Yeah, that was. I remember that. I went to the. Went to get a beer, and the bartender at the Mod Club is like, what is this? Like, what is going
they didn't
on?
Understand.
No, and I mean, and that's an example of a comedy thing that is so inside.
Yeah.
Like, you have to be inside of it to get any of the
jokes. Yeah, that's true. Like, I noticed that you could see that. I could sort of see people, boyfriends or girlfriends brought their partners or vice, whatever. That people were just brought their dates, and you could see that some of them just looked puzzled as to what have you brought me to here?
Yeah.
But I enjoyed it. I thought it was fun.
I had a tremendous time.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a big fan of those guys.
Yeah.
I've got the box set around the corner.
Do you
somewhere.
Have the box set?
I do, yeah.
You got a piece of the phone?
I did, yes.
Good for you.
It's still in there. Of course, I'm a fool. And when I got it, I didn't know there was a USB stick.
Oh.
So I spent like 5 hours ripping CDs onto my old computer. But yeah.
No, and that's fine. I mean, those guys, would you say they're related in any way to the Kids in the Hall? Do you see a trajectory there, a through line?
Maybe. I mean, Tom Sharpling was nice enough to blurb the book, incidentally. And we just kind of struck up a conversation because he had Kevin MacDonald from the Kids in the Hall on the show. And in Canada, if you want to clear stuff that's been used by previous sources, you can't just take it like you can in the States. So I had to email him and ask for permission. He said, of course. But I don't know. I Sharpling and Worcester to me is sort of its own thing.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something of SCTV in them in the way that they create this sort of fake city of Newbridge with its various denizens and locales.
Yep.
Kids in the Hall doesn't really do that. Tim and Eric, I guess, kind of did that with Tom Goes to the Mayor. But yeah, I mean, to them, it's more, I mean, phone comedy is its own.
It's radio. It's a throwback almost.
Sort of
radio,
thing.
Radio plays of Yonder? What? I don't know what. Yeah, that's not right. I don't think Yonder. But
if I could, for the sake of relating it to the Kids in the Hall, I say that, I mean, a lot of the humor in Sharpling and Worcester basically comes out of most of Worcester's characters are people who are sort of smugly self-confident.
Yes.
And don't understand that they're delusional, and in that way become kind of pitiable. And there's a lot of characters like that on Kids in the Hall that you see. I mean, I write about this in the book, I think, where, you know, they have the businessmen or the sort of bad dad characters.
Yeah.
And they're there to be mocked and to be made fun of, but there's a level of obliviousness to it that makes them a bit more sympathetic.
Right. They don't. And in some ways, if we're really going to connect Sharpling and Worcester to Kids in the Hall, Tom is almost like a viewer of the show. Like, he's an incredulous, like, what?
Exactly.
Like, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? Kind of like, yeah. So I wondered about that, because you seem to be a fan of groundbreaking alternative comedy, right?
Sure. Yeah, I like that stuff. I mean, Kids in the Hall is big for me. Mr. Show was huge for me. I'm always saying this, what I'm about to say. Every day I say it. But I think sort of the trifecta for comedy for me was Kids in the Hall and Mr. Show and The Simpsons, which is not sketch, obviously.
Right.
But that's the sort of Predator-style triangle through which I can like line up how I see the world.
Right. And you saw at least Kids in the Hall. You talk about this in the book, and I think it happened with The Simpsons with you as well. It happened to me a little bit. I started watching The Simpsons when it was on primetime.
Right.
But then it became syndicated, and so you'd get home from school, and I don't know if it was the same as mine, but it's sort of bizarre to me that when I was like not even 10, I could watch Cheers and Night Court and The Simpsons, which are not for kids, really,
no.
At any way, I would say. And did you have a similar kind of
upbringing? Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, Kids in the Hall, I sort of came up watching when the Comedy Network would put it on in syndication. And I think it used to be in a 4 o'clock or a 4:30 slot. And I remember there was
in the afternoon.
Yeah, yeah.
Seems bizarre to me.
And but there was a, I remember like being able to work it out because especially growing up in Niagara where we would get a lot of the U.S. stations a lot clearer, you know, you could string together a block of 2 hours where you're watching nothing but The Simpsons in syndication.
Right. You'd hop around.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And CFMT to Fox 29. That's right. This and that. But yeah, and as I try to write about that idea that you kind of become obsessed with things and this sort of insane culture of fandom and stuff that we live in now, which is a bit much even for me to fathom. Like it's got even deeper than people of my generation can kind of make sense of. But I think that all kind of started in a way with watching stuff in syndication, watching stuff in repeats. What's the Springsteen song? 57 channels and nothing.
That's
on.
Right. That's right.
It's like that, except like 57 that. Channels and only The Simpsons is on. You know?
So were you primarily like you're a music guy too? You like music?
I like music. I would say my taste in music is more limited. I don't write about music as much as I like because I can't fake it. Like I can't review a bad album like I can a bad movie or a bad book.
Huh.
But there's stuff that I like. But that, you know, at the same time, it'll be like, I can't pitch the Global Mail and be like, let me write about this like pioneering female black metal artist.
Right,
and they'd be
sure.
Like, yeah, nobody cares.
You're a metal guy? You're mostly metal?
I like that stuff. And I like a lot of stuff. Yeah.
But growing up in Niagara, do you remember if it was comedy? Like you say, you got home and you'd watch The Simpsons. Like you'd figure out how to watch The Simpsons all day, basically. But were you a music person first?
Yeah, comedy and like classic rock, like listening to classic rock radio with my dad. And then from that, hearing like Paranoid and Run to the Hills, like the sort of metal songs that would make it into the classic rock rotation. And then from there, by like middle school, it was a lot of that stuff. And also I used to be into like, in that day, it was like a big period for like big beat electro, like of like Prodigy records and Chemical Brothers records. But I was such a small town and like no scene or anything, or, you know, the internet was just kind of bubbling up. So it's like, I would listen to a Prodigy record and I wouldn't even really know that it wasn't rock music, you know?
Oh, I see.
Like I wasn't even aware that there was like this thing called electro music.
Right.
Because it would play on the alt rock stations and you would see it in the Much Countdown and all this stuff. And, you know, those guys had their stupid cartoonish like 90s bad boy poses. But yeah. And then in high school, was a bit in the sort of like metalcore, hardcore scene, but pretty much a poser, like pretty much went to the shows for something to do. Because
you're
was
a fan? Did you play music?
Not really. Okay. No. But yeah, went to, and you know, I had buddies in like screamo bands and stuff.
Right.
You know, we grew up around like when Alexis on Fire was coming up in St. Catharines.
Yep.
So that was like the sort of style or the thing that everyone wanted to be, for better or worse.
Mm-hmm.
Or we would go to hardcore shows in Buffalo and stuff like that.
Right.
But I never really liked it as much as, I wasn't as sincere about it as some of my friends were.
About music?
About that kind of music.
Oh, I see.
About like going to an 18 Visions concert. I'm like, yeah, I'll go because what am I going to do? And, you know, we'll like drink shitty beer and mosh and be teenagers.
Right.
But then the stuff I really got into in high school is coming across like Constellation Records stuff.
Okay.
Like, you know, so I'd be like the loser who would be listening to like F sharp, A sharp, Infinity by Godspeed You Black Emperor in his car.
You're not a loser. That's not a loser. You're not a loser. Don't call yourself a loser.
I felt like that at the time. Okay, if you say so. I'm being self-deprecating. It's meant to be charming.
It was. But I worry at the same time because, you know, Godspeed, it's kind of a cool thing to like now.
Oh, for sure.
And you felt like a loser liking it when you first
But really, I was just ahead of the curve.
You were.
But I'll tell you, the commingling, this is a thing about this sort of post-taste era or something. I went to those shows in Montreal where it was co-headlining Neurosis and Godspeed You Black Emperor. And it's like, that is a thing. And I still love Neurosis. I think they're one of the great bands. But it's like, I would have never imagined that that would be a bill. If you were to tell me in high school, I would have lost my mind. I mean, I lost my mind as an adult when they announced it. But this is the thing, is we live in this kind of era, which is easy to make fun of. This is why I have a hard time keeping up with music, because I feel like there's an expectation to have opinions about things you don't like.
It's a, you're encouraged to be a generalist.
Yeah. Or it's like, if I don't like a Justin Bieber single, like I'm a hater or something. And it's like, it's not even about hate. It's like, I just don't care.
Right. You're supposed to talk about everything.
Exactly.
Even if you have no foothold in it or expertise or opinion.
Yeah.
You're just expected to say something.
But at the same time, it's like, oh, you could conceivably double bill like an experimental metal band and like this sort of, what do you even call it? Post-rock, I guess.
Yeah, whatever. They don't like that, but yeah.
Yeah, it's a stupid term.
Yes, no one knows what to call whatever Godspeed is.
Yeah, yeah, but it's one of those things that just kind of when you see it, it intuitively makes sense, yeah. You know? Yeah. I don't think it would have made sense as much maybe 15 years ago.
The things you're talking about are sort of dark, they're sort of angsty.
Yeah, for sure.
And then the comedy you gravitated towards was at least a little sardonic, a little edgy. So you have this... I see a darkness in you, John, is what I'm saying. Is that what's going on?
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I do think about that stuff. I mean, I the Kids in the Hall definitely is like a dark show
it's
to me.
It's pretty dark.
Mr. Show is like, there's dark stuff on it.
Well, Mr. Show in particular is not only dark, but it's so critical.
Yeah.
Of everything.
Contemptuous.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
And Tim and Eric is like super dark. I mean, people toss the word Lynchian around a lot, but I think that a lot of Tim and Eric stuff, especially their bedtime story show, like that's actually Lynchian. Like that's about taking the sort of banality of everyday life and making it horrifying.
But there's a certain amount of, if you're a fan of those things, there's a certain level of escapism because they make things so surreal that you lose yourself a little bit. You just kind of lose track of wherever you are, because you're like, what is this world I'm being brought into? So you're drawn to that stuff.
Yeah, obviously. And I think that humor, I think that the humor I like is always sort of, I mean, it's impossible to talk about anything without being self-conscious. Like, to say I like dark humor.
No,
and
I know.
Like, oh, I like to tell dead baby jokes or like something pathetic.
Well, no, but I mean, I'm trying to get a sense of you.
Sure,
so,
But no, I do think that humor is one of the best ways at like dealing with dark subjects.
Yeah.
And in literature too, like a lot of the books I gravitated to were like when you're a teenager and you read like Kafka and it's mind blowing because it's these crazy little fairy tales and they're funny and they're sort of like suicidally depressing at the same time. And you can't really make sense of it, but there's something, you know, that whole whistling past the grave thing.
There's a little bit of existential crises occurring in the Kids in the Hall, would you say?
Yeah, I think so. I think that like a lot of the humor proceeds from them being outcasts.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a little rich to say, oh, these like white guys with Mick last names in Canada are outcasts. Yeah. But I think they all kind of came from a place comedically and in their personal lives where like they weren't the cool guys. And of course that is what ends up making them the cool guys.
Right. Well, you mentioned in your... By the way, I haven't said this yet, but your book's amazing.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's called This is a Book About the Kids in the Hall.
Yeah. It's a very bad title.
No, it's not a bad title. It's just a mouthful to say off the top of my head.
Right.
Or mindful to say. But anyway, it's a great book. And as someone who's followed that troupe and got to see them in sort of the early days, or maybe I think the first time I saw them live was actually just post the series.
Okay.
But I followed the series. I don't think I was an appropriate age to go see the Kids in the Hall live.
And right.
Maybe they didn't do it so much. But anyway, I followed them very closely and certainly saw Brain Candy in the theaters. You know, like I'm old is my point here.
Hey,
John.
I saw Brain Candy in theaters.
Did you?
It just kind of went over my head. I think I would have been 9 or 10.
You got into Brain Candy at 9 or 10 years old?
Maybe.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
We used to, there was a small movie theater and my mom used to be pretty good about, maybe this is incriminating if people hear it, but she's retired. So what are they going to do to her?
I think, to be honest though, Brain Candy is like PG-13.
Yeah.
It's not restricted.
But she used to be good about buying a ticket and then like coming to the theater with me and my friends and then just like meeting us in the parking lot after.
Right.
If we wanted to see an R-rated movie or something.
You could do that.
Yeah.
That's good. And that probably gave you an entry point into... You say you like movies.
Well, not really, because we were seeing utter trash. Like, Mom, take us to see Spawn, the movie, because like they won't let us in.
Right.
It's not like we were going to see Last Tango in Paris and like needed adult accompaniment or
sure.
something.
Sure. No, I hear you. Well, the point is, like, you know, in the book, you talk about their backgrounds and their. I think everyone but Mark McKinney had kind of a dad issue, right?
Yeah. And Mark McKinney, in his own way, had a dad who was like an absent, you know, government bureaucrat father. They all kind
follow
of
around.
Yeah, they moved around a lot. Yeah, they all kind of had dad issues in one way or the other, which is why I think dads are one of the main subjects on the show that they make fun
dads
of.
Dads and businessmen in particular.
Authority. I mean, it's...
Right.
And that's pre-Mr. Show. I mean, Mr. Show to me is like almost a satirical recasting of the sort of Gen X grunge sensibility. Yeah. Like, it's when it becomes ironic, where it's like, I hate this is already in quotes. But the kids in the hall was like, I hate this. I think these people are foolish.
So when you say when you talk about their backgrounds, that really informs a lot of their sensibility.
I think so. I mean, and I know I literally cite Freud in the book, but
you do.
I want to be careful about sort of these cheap psychopathologies of these people as men. But all I can say is like what I know about their personal histories and what comes out in the show. And yeah, I mean, I think there is a connection in that sense.
I remember being struck by that section of the book because I just don't know your background. Is psychological studies? Is that
what something? I read a lot of and read a lot of and study in school is like critical theory, they call it now, which a lot of is like post-Freudian theory. So as much as I don't necessarily believe in that stuff as a psychological system, I do think you find in that a lot of sort of useful myths for like how to understand the Western world, like how to understand relationships of authority. And again, I don't think it's like inalienably true, but it's true in some cases.
Right.
That, you know, sons have issues with their dads. Well, sons want to fight their dads.
Right. And then, so they've got all this lampooning of father figures, authority figures. Among their real innovations was embracing, I guess you'd call it cross-dressing.
Right. Yeah.
For lack of a better term, like they would go and drag.
Right.
And that was also unique. They really embraced it. And, you know, full on, you know, I was going to say man on man action, but they would kiss each other
for sure
on stage.
Well, there's a sketch I write about at length, Comfortable, where
yes,
the sort of dinner party that breaks down and it ends with Scott Thompson like mounting his best friend's wife, played by Kevin McDonald.
Right.
But the word drag is something I try to think about in the book a bit because
yes,
when you think about drag, you think about a sort of performance of the opposite gender in a very sort of broad, stereotypical way. And you look at Monty Python and like that's what they would do with drag. Right. It's like, I'm playing an old crone and the joke is sort of, isn't that funny that I'm a man in a dress? But for the kids in the hall, I mean, they do have jokes like that, but a lot of the drag was just, well, we want to have female characters and there's no women in the troupe, which itself was pragmatic. Whenever they would try to have women in, they would end up getting poached by Second City or
yes,
whatever.
Yes, I remember that. Yeah.
So we have to play these characters ourselves. And, you know, maybe you can say they're three-dimensional characters, two-dimensional characters, maybe. But they're not. The joke is not just that it's drag, that it's a man in a dress.
You're right.
Like they're playing female characters who are themselves making jokes.
Right. No, and that's a fair point. But does that speak to any of the their comfort level with that?
I think so. I mean, there is something transgressive about it, I guess. Yeah. I mean, in the 80s and 90s, you know, there was something, and especially with Scott Thompson in the troupe. I mean, I think when people think about the kids in the hall, there's a gayness or queerness to it, I guess, which is part of its lingering legacy.
But I think there's also like a pragmatic analysis of manhood.
Yeah, for sure.
What it means to be a man. I don't have a background in, you know, psychology per se, but it, as I was reading your book, that all kind of came out, like it just sort of came up for me, like this notion of them constantly lampooning, critiquing, questioning this notion of manhood.
Right. Well, they kind of grew up with these sort of, you know, greatest generation, stiff, repressed dads. Like, I guess, you know, like my own father, certainly his father to an extent, you know, this idea of a Canadian dad that you have, you know, sitting in the Barca lounger, drinking a glass of Canadian Club, would never tell you he loved you. Basically, and this isn't a Canadian character, but like Martin Crane on Frasier.
Right.
Like
right.
this right. sort of idea of a sort of, you know, emotionally repressed, like hemorrhoid pillow owning father.
Right.
Yeah. So I think when you come out of that and you sort of realize the effect that has on you, it is transgressive, I guess, to not be like that.
So did you relate to them because of any, like, did that resonate with you personally? Or was that just,
Well,
is that something you discovered in writing the book, or is that like
in certain yeah. ways? I mean, we all have sort of issues with parents and stuff like that. But when I was growing up, I love my parents and stuff like that. I don't sure. want to sound ungrateful,
sure.
But it's like if you're a little different, maybe, and not necessarily supportive of that, or like not getting that. There's not a handbook of how to raise a kid, or they might do stuff that's. They might like music, or they might get in trouble, but it's okay. Like, I don't know.
Were you, I think part of me was drawn to stuff that I didn't think I was supposed to see.
Right. For sure. There's with the kids in the hall, for sure. There's like your parents walk in on you watching it. You change the channel really
yeah.
quick.
Yeah.
There it has that quality for sure.
Yeah.
Which I remember a bit of, but, and a lot of that is like, you know, the cross dressing and just the stupidity of it.
Yeah.
Like I remember as a kid, being embarrassed watching like Chicken Lady sketches, and yeah, there's ones where she like has an orgasm and feathers go everywhere, but it's more just like the idiocy of it.
Yeah,
like that was a thing growing up too. It's like I was always worried that my parents thought I was like an idiot because I would like stupid stuff, or
right,
like
sure.
I went to a Catholic school on an out of uniform days, like me and my friends would just dress like idiots,
right?
Like we would be wearing like 70s bell bottoms and like try to look like Kramer because we thought it was like cool,
right?
Just weirdos.
You were kind of an idiot.
I was an idiot,
yeah,
but a smart idiot, yeah. I think. But or, you know, my parents never liked my friends because the sort of assumption is, well, they got to be idiots too if they're friends with this guy.
Yeah, sure,
you know?
Sure.
So there was always that sort of worry with the kids in the hall. It's like or, you know, you think of like Flying Pig or these things, and it's just like...
They were silly, stupid things.
Yeah.
They were just like, funny. They made them laugh and they made us laugh.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's what comedy's supposed to do.
Right.
But I can understand. Yeah. I think I tried to weirdly shield my parents from some of the stuff I liked too.
It's like my friends and I talk about this a lot, how when you're a kid and you're watching a movie with your family and you know when like a nipple or something in a
yeah.
phone is coming up and you like plan to go get like a Coke or to go to the
washroom. Right, you leave the room.
When it's happening, because the worst feeling in the world is like being in the room when you're like 12 and there's like a breast and you and your dad are in the same room.
Well, you don't, it's for me, I was always like, I just don't want to have to explain this.
Yeah.
Like it's awkward, but I just, it was more awkward to me, the prospect of having to try to explain what I was seeing
right
in some way or commenting on it. Yeah, it's pure pain. But anyway, so you discovered them on reruns and they spoke to you personally. I feel like the first thing I encountered between you and the kids in the hall was this oral history. Is that
for Now Magazine? Yeah.
In 2013.
Yeah. And a lot of the interviews in the book sort of came out of that
because yeah.
I did so much researching and, I mean, the genesis of the book was really that story.
Yeah.
You know what it's like as a journalist. You get so much material and then it's like even a bigger story like that, it's like I have all this stuff.
I did a Godspeed You Black Emperor timeline for Exclaim magazine and it's insanely long and I should turn that into a book probably
yeah.
If someone listening wants me to write a book about Godspeed for them, I would be happy to do it. It's pretty much done. But so that's what happened? You had
basically
all your access to them was from that period?
And before. There's
okay.
There's a lot of other interviews I've done with them over the years. And then basically what happened is I got a literary agent and the question came, like, what is a thing you could sit down and start writing a book about tomorrow?
Right.
And the answer in my mind was the kids in the hall, like something I knew a lot about,
right.
cared a lot about. So yeah, we just kind of went from there. But the other thing is that Now oral history, and this might sound a bit horn-tooty, but that was a huge story. Like, I was the online editor at Now at the time, so I would compulsively
yep.
look at traffic and yep. all this stuff. And that was, like, the second-ranked story all year after, like, Best Pizza in Toronto. And that was the year when Rob Ford was, like, smoking crack.
Right,
and
right.
And talking about how much he loves to eat out his wife. Can I say eat out?
Yeah, you can say eat out.
Yeah.
Sure.
Anyways, I'm not saying it. He was saying it.
Okay, yeah.
He's the disgusting
Well, you mentioned the best pizza link, too, so but it's a little gray area.
Yeah. So, anyways, the point is, like, in a year where there was no shortage of, like, local
yeah,
scandal
yeah.
People, that Now and everyone was reporting on, there were still, like, hundreds of thousands of people who wanted to read an oral history about the kids in the hall.
What does that say about... I mean, obviously, that says something about the kids in the hall, and maybe the answer is obvious, but at the same time, they still seem like this cult phenomenon to so many of us, and you talk about that in the book a lot too, and they talk about that themselves. You know, there's this quote from Bruce McCullough about how everything they touch turns to cult,
right?
Which I viewed as this that could be a point of pride. That could be a point of like, we're just doomed to be obscure.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, it helps them. It helps people like us champion them, doesn't it?
Exactly.
But at the same time, most, well, except for some pizza, and that's the most read story. So something's going on with this.
But still, I mean,
group of people.
You know, again, for the context, to say that it was the second most read story at Now Magazine, a Toronto Alt Weekly in a year, that's still a pretty
narrow pretty small, focus. Sure.
But yeah, I mean, I think part of it, especially with the Toronto connection, is, I mean, now Toronto is like certifiably cool. Like it's a cool place to live. It's a cool place to visit. When I go to like Canadian Music Week parties and people from New York are like, oh, we used to hate coming up to Toronto, but like now we love it. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's basically because of Drake and the Raptors and the Blue Jays. And that's great. But you go back further and some people will say 10, 15 years ago, broken social scene. Oh, that's when Toronto became cool. And it's nice for me and some other people, I guess, to be like, well, what about 20 years before that when there was like this super weird, hyper original sketch comedy troupe? And like, you know, at the time, you can make all these jokes about Kids in the Hall, like Toronto's original collective, and all, you know, the original Seattle moment.
Right, right. In some ways, that's not that off the mark, is it?
Well, the Seattle, the grunge thing is something that I sort of try to drive home a bit, where it's that same sort of disaffected flannel shirt sensibility, just coming out in the form of jokes instead of like mournful guitar solos.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's also a period where, you know, when I talk about Queen West in the book, like the Queen West that's described to me or that I read about when I'm reading about Queen West in the mid 80s, which I have no firsthand experience of, is like a foreign country. It's like describing Leipzig or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, there was like, you know, people like junkies and punks everywhere. It's like, what? There's like a knapsack store and like an A&W there now.
Yeah, 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 exactly. Yeah, Toronto's different. And it's that's for someone who's familiar with the city, spends a lot of time in Toronto. That's the other window into this culture that I'm grateful for because of your book, because I had sort of blanked on the fact that they really set up a place like a home base at the Rivoli.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you walk into the Rivoli, it's kind of an unassuming little place at the back of the restaurant or whatever it is, but it's amazing that it's like this weird comedy mecca, right?
Well, I think that's the other thing that really made it work is because, you know, and I love comedy, but I gotta tell you, I hate going to comedy clubs. Like,
yeah,
even the cool ones, like Comedy Bar. It's like there's something about it. Something about it rubs me the wrong way. I don't know, but at the time, it's like, okay, you would go to Second City.
Is it the pressure? Is it because I would think, more than even a rock show, you go into a comedy club, there is I feel like the atmosphere is a little tense.
Yeah, I mean, it has the same quality to me as live theater, which is that I like, you go to a movie, and there's like, it's almost like a film, well, no pun, but like, there's like
oh, I see.
Like there's a barrier between you and what's going on. Same at a concert in a way, because there's so many people there, and it's not like you're supposed to be observant or necessarily reverent of it in a way, but it's like, you kind of end up feeling embarrassed for people or something, or it's not
at a comedy club.
Well, even when people are funny, it's like there's an intimacy to it that I don't like. Like I don't like that a person can like look at me and like see me and stuff like that.
Well, it's also, I think, the fact that a musician or
there's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Some of the other platforms you were discussing, there's some kind of, like for a musician, they have a guitar, they have drums, they have a microphone, something that they're kind of working with.
Right.
Theater might be the same thing on some level, but a comedian walks up on stage with a microphone.
Right.
And so the intimacy level is, right away it's heightened compared to almost any other thing. And it's just them and their mind. We're going to experience them and their perspective together, and it could fail.
Yeah.
And I think it creates this slight tension in the atmosphere.
Right.
What are they going to do? Like, what are they going to do to make us laugh?
Exactly. And, you know, you live and die on that last laugh. But I think why I brought this up is because with the Rivoli, I think there's something to be said about seeing comedy in a context where it's not known for comedy.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, the kids in the hall will be here, but oh, there's a punk band the next night, or oh, there's like a weird clown acrobat from OCAD the night before. And I think in that context, there's less pressure, you know?
Yeah.
Like if I go to comedy shows, like they'll be at like the Ossington on Ossington, where it's like a bar and they have a comedy night and stuff like that. Yeah. And when you're less in that sort of two drink minimum comedy club, red light flashing, time to take your seats, environment, I feel like you're kind of, your guard is let down and you can be exposed to things that are funnier or weirder and that. Yeah. And I mean, I love to laugh. I love jokes, but like a lot of time I'd rather just like watch a funny movie or sit around.
You don't like live comedy. You don't like live comedy generally.
Sometimes. I mean, here's the thing. My enjoyment of it at the time, I'm always like, why don't I do this more often? And then I just don't end up doing it more often.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, a friend of mine summed it up really well, where he says, there's nothing more embarrassing than a man telling a joke.
Like, there is this thing among, I grew up with some people like this who really hated comedians. The kind of smug notion that they might be smarter or funnier. Funnier than you, I think it puts some people off.
I've had bad experiences in like the real world with comedians, and there's people who are always on or like they can't give it away. And like I have like funny friends. A lot of my friends are like the funniest people I know in the world, and they're not comedians, but we like sit around cracking jokes and stuff like that. But a lot of times you try to do that with comedians and they're almost like stroking their chin, or like they're trying to find an angle into it.
Well,
or they'll do shtick.
I do find that in my job, if this is a job, in my various jobs interviewing people, I find comedians to be the most unpredictable and often difficult interviews.
Right.
Because and I've learned this the hard way, and in some cases I've just been told it's true. You're very good at, here's where I'm going with this, and I'm gonna take my deficiency and turn it into a compliment for you.
Wow.
Here's what, watch this.
This is like magic.
Well, I used to interview comedians, and I think when you're starting out interviewing people or you first begin interviewing comedians, there is this impulse, because you follow them and you follow comedy and you're a journalist, that you might be as funny as them.
Or you try to be funny. I've done that.
It's very dangerous, right? Because what happens is the comedian's like, ah, great. I got to talk to someone else who thinks they're hilarious.
Right.
And then they're immediately, you know, their back is up a little bit. So I've learned when I'm talking to comedians, unless I feel like a natural chemistry or it feels like I can throw in a little thing, but I have learned to just be the straight interviewer and let them be funny. But it still doesn't always work out. I think comedians, there's a neurosis. There is a slight conceitedness or egocentrism or something that goes on there that I don't encounter with authors or musicians. There's maybe more humility. I don't know. I think there's something about the comedian's lifestyle. Like I said earlier, it's just you and your brain and a microphone.
Right.
You're not hiding behind anything else. I think it gives you a tough exterior.
Well, yeah. I mean, certainly some of the worst interviews I've done are with comedians. And for both reasons that you're describing. I mean, I remember the first time I interviewed Tim and Eric, like I was trying to be like a yuck 'em up, like making jokes. And it was totally that. They're like, who is this idiot?
Right. By the way, I forgot to turn this into the compliment part. I only talked about my deficiency and people like me. But I also made it a feel-good story, right? Because
Turned
around is
right.
I've come to terms with what I need to be doing in my job.
Right.
What I was going to say is what you've done so magically is you've written a book about the kids in the hall, and your prose is funny. You write funny.
Right. I appreciate that.
And it's an entertaining, it's not simply a, I wasn't just like hungry for the tidbits about the kids in the hall. I liked your approach, which was sort of irreverent and very present. Like it feels very contemporary. You're kind of dropping little references to stuff. That's a bold idea.
Yeah.
You kind of...
Some readers don't like it, I should say.
Oh, is that right?
Well, you know...
You're reading all your reviews.
I've become a vain, egotistical...
Well, you want to know what people maniac. Are saying. But so some people might not... Is it the same thing that they're like, this guy thinks he's as funny
he
as...
He should leave himself out of it.
Right.
He thinks he's... One thing was like, he thinks he's as funny as they are, but he's not... It's like, I don't think I'm as funny as they are, but...
But that's the thing. When we do what we do, and we're talking to people, you kind of want... What you're doing, I think, is you're trying to convey to them that you are engaged in their culture.
Exactly, yeah.
And so you're trying to say, I am as... It's possible I might have a joke because I just... I'm immersed in joke culture and comedy culture.
Right.
So you're trying to relate to them, but it can actually backfire horribly.
Yeah. And I mean, some of the best compliments that I've had about the book are from friends who are like, reading it feels like talking to you.
Right.
Which would normally horrify me because when I write journalism, I mean, the reason that I love writing is because I find when I have the time to like sort of be alone with my thoughts and get them into order, I find I'm able to think about things more clearly and to bring that clarity into writing about them.
Yeah.
But a book, when you have this larger canvas, it's like, I didn't want to maintain that sustained sense of intensity or like critical seriousness. So like, I wanted to write it more informally and I wanted it to sound like, not funny, but I guess irreverent. Yeah. I mean, that's all conscientious.
Well, but you're critical, too. Like, it's not hagiography. It's, you are actually, like, you talk about the fact that when the Kids in the Hall sort of broke apart for a spell after, basically, for those who don't know, I guess we should summarize a little
bit.
Sure,
yeah.
You tell the story about the Kids in the Hall, how they came together, and it's basically this cross-country connection where Bruce McCullough and Mark McKinney were in Alberta doing comedy, and Kevin McDonald and Dave Foley were in Toronto doing comedy as the Kids in the Hall. And Bruce and Mark moved to Ontario, to Toronto, because Bruce was really into punk, and mm-hmm. Toronto was where punk was in Canada, so, and comedy as well. So they moved to Ontario. They become the Kids in the Hall. Scott Thompson throws donuts at them, kind of as weirdly heckling them. During one of their performances, he ends up in the Kids in the Hall. They end up with this TV talk show after gaining a reputation for their live show. the TV show is on HBO. It's on CBC. It's eventually on CBS.
Yeah.
And
you really read the book, eh?
I did, yeah. And then they Shadowy Man on a Shadowy Planet, one of my favorite bands of all time, do the songs and
cheap strip music, Lorne Michaels called it.
Yeah, when Don Pyle and I were talking about it, he used the term cheap porno music, but strips porno, I remember being struck by that because I'd never heard that before. Yeah, Lorne Michaels didn't, and I want to talk about Lorne Michaels because you talked to Lorne Michaels.
Yeah.
For the book, or was it for
the book, yeah.
How was that?
Oh my God, it was so funny.
Was it a hard thing to get done?
It was hard to get him on the phone, like just to schedule it. It kept getting rescheduled because he's like, he owns more minutes of television than anyone in the history of the medium.
Yeah, he does right now. Yeah.
You know, he produces everything and he's Lorne Michaels. But it was pretty funny. I mean, I recently interviewed Warren Beatty, so I think Lorne Michaels goes to number two for like most famous person I've ever talked
to. Yeah, I saw that.
I remember saying that to Lorne Michaels. I was like, you know, I think you're probably the most famous guy I've ever talked to. He's like, well, who would be the second most famous person you've ever spoken to? I'm like, oh, I don't know, maybe Will Ferrell? He says, well, I'm certainly more famous than Will Ferrell.
That's a good Lorne, by the way.
Everyone,
very strong.
Everyone has a good Lorne Michaels
impression.
Everyone
does kind of a Lorne Michaels impression. Yeah, I can't do it.
Like
yours was better.
Dr. Evil.
Yes.
But he was really great and so giving.
Were you freaked out talking to Lorne? I'd be a little freaked out talking to Lorne Michaels.
Yeah, a little nerve-wracking just because of like the pomp and circumstance, like his assistant, okay, we're going to have 20 minutes with Lauren for you,
right.
90 minutes, we'll give you a call, we'll patch you through.
Right.
It's like you're getting on with the president or something. But he was really nice. And like the thing that really struck me is he was so eager and proud of the Kids in the Hall.
Yeah, he loves the Kids in the Hall.
He was proud that he had his name on this thing.
Comes through in the book.
Yeah, and it's like when you think about it now that like this is a guy who, you know, produces like The Tonight Show, the biggest shows on TV.
And Saturday Night Live.
And then these little documentary now, Portlandia,
yeah.
All these things.
Yeah.
But it's like he still has like a real pride of place for the Kids in the Hall.
Yep.
And the other thing that was good to talk to him is he was so quick to like fact check things that the other guys in the troupe had said.
Did he know it off the top of his head?
Basically. Huh. Yeah, like so quick to be like, like, oh, I never told Scott Thompson that being gay is the kiss of death. That's a ridiculous thing to say. But then, like, kind of back by the neck, you know, I did explain that you might not want to be openly gay because it limits your chances. I'm like, oh, so I mean, you know, kiss of death may be a euphemism, but right. in as many words.
I could see Scott interpreting it as that. Yeah. No, it's such a vivid story because there's so many amazingly talented people whose voices, like Bob Odenkirk and all these people, show up in your book. And, you know, knowing how things work, I assume you've talked to them about other things and you managed to throw in the odd Kids in the Hall question.
Yeah, well, the Odenkirk one was certainly that. I was talking to him and David Cross about the sort of Mr. Show revival with Bob and David on Netflix.
Yeah.
And that was a case of just kind of like sliding in.
Yeah, request. Some Kids in the Hall stuff.
So like a cheap reporterly trick.
No, it's
but
good.
People like Janine Garofalo was another really funny interview, just because I made so many overtures to get through to her through various people, and you know how it is often when you're trying to contact people where you can tell the manager or the agent is not even approaching them. They're just and I remember, I forget what I said, but I said something, I was like, look, if you just, I guarantee if you just ask her, she might want to talk. So you know, what does it take? And then I'm over at the coffee shop, I'm coming home, bringing my laundry home, and my phone rings. And it was an unknown number. And this was around the time when I was getting a lot of those calls. Yeah. When you pick it up, it's like, what? Congratulations, you have won a deep sea cruise.
Right.
So I pick up the phone. I'm like, what? What do you want? And I'm all pissed off. And she's like, is this John? I'm like, yeah, who's this? It's like, oh, it's Janine Garofalo. And I'm like, oh, shit. Sorry, I'm like getting harassed by telemarketers all week. And she's like, no, I get it. She's like, yeah, I want to talk to you about the Kids in the Hall. I'm like, all right, let me just get my recorder out. She's like, well, you don't want to like do it another time or like schedule it? I'm like, no, let's just go. She's like, oh, I thought you'd have to like write questions. And it's like, I've been up to my ears writing a book about this thing. Right. Like, you know,
I'm trying to get her on the horn too. I want to ask her Larry Sanders Show questions.
Yes, I talked to her a bit about that because she and Scott Thompson were on that.
Yeah.
But she was great, really, for like, just again, someone who was a big fan of the Kids
in
the Hall.
Yeah.
And obviously, such a sort of, to me, Janine Garofalo sort of signifies the idea of alternative comedy in the stand up space.
Right.
So she was very informed about that and told me a really nice story about how when she was on SNL and when Mark McKinney was on SNL after the Kids in the Hall show ended, which were kind of like, dump years for SNL. No offense to them. They had amazingly talented people.
Yeah, I know. It was just a weird time.
Yeah. But they went out to a bar and she said something that like made Mark McKinney laugh. And that just like tickled her so much.
Point of pride for her to make someone
and
like
another
that
funny story. She was supposed to be in Brain Candy. Oh. Ended up cutting the scene, but she was in Toronto shooting it. And the next morning she's like, could I meet the Vacant Lot? Like a sketch show with Mark McKinney's brother that ran for like one season on CBC. And you know, she would have been like on the Ben Stiller Show at the time, like pretty famous profile.
And
like,
Janine was also in the stocking sketch with Bruce McCullough on Saturday Night Live.
That's right. Yeah. That? Bruce McCullough made a lot of those short
films. Yeah. The short films there. Yeah. And so she played, I was just listening to Bruce McCullough's album, Shame Based Man, the other day. I was going to say I dusted it off, but I found it on Apple Music.
Another CD I used to listen to in my car, incidentally.
I have it. I have the CD. I could have put it in my car today. All this to say, I was trying to give people a sense of what happened. Kids in the Hall have a TV show. TV show interest starts to wane. They start to feel like it's done. Yeah, it's run its course. They stop doing the TV show. They start touring a little bit. They work on this movie, Brain Candy. It doesn't go well. The creative process is horrible. Yeah, Dave Foley is kind of essentially excommunicated from the troupe.
And written out of the film. He doesn't get a writing credit.
Yeah, so there's a lot of acrimony there. And then they don't really speak too much. They reconvene, and now they're sort of here and there. They did a TV show for CBC, Death Comes to Town, and they will tour occasionally. So that's, in a nutshell,
exactly
what you've done with your book. You've told this story, but you've told it in a very vivid and humorous way, and I don't care what anyone says. I actually appreciated...
Get on Amazon and...
should I do that? No. I appreciated your flourishes.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
As a writer.
Yeah.
And I don't know where I started. I'm all over the place today. I apologize. But
that's okay.
What I was going to say is, it's not just a fan gushing about the Kids in the Hall. You are critical of them on some level. You're critical of certain sketches that maybe don't resonate or seem appropriate today. You are, you know, it's fair to say that when, I mentioned this recently in print somewhere about your book, where chemistry is often a term we overuse.
Mm-hmm.
But it occurs to you, I think, that they are, and they realize it at this point too, that they, beyond the demand and the name recognition, they seem to be beholden to one another creatively. They work best.
I like how you make it sound like it's some sort of like weird blood pact. Like every five years we must reunite and feed the beast.
But it does. What you discover, because you, I believe the book starts with you on the set of Dave Foley's show on CTV,
Spun Out,
which is not a good show by any stretch of the imagination. It's just not a good show. But Dave is the star of the show, and it's made in Canada, right?
Yes.
And on one episode,
it reeks of being made in Canada,
right? And on one episode, at least one episode, who knows how many by now? But the one that you recount in your book, the rest of the kids in the hall show up,
right,
to appear, and they work together, and they riff, and they kind of punch up some scenes, and it's just clear to you that this is good for them,
yeah,
to be working together, and they've come to, after years apart. I mentioned Bruce, and Bruce and Mark did some film work and SNL work. Scott, I think, still has this really interesting acting career. Kevin, as you mentioned, kind of was a character actor, did some stuff.
Yeah, he was on Seinfeld famously, yes, as a denim,
yes,
vest. He teaches a lot of like sketch workshops and stuff,
yes,
like that.
Yes.
But yeah, they're always better when they're together. And to talk about two things that you kind of brought up.
Yeah, sorry, I'm all over the place. No, but thank you for trying to parse something out of
that's
all
okay.
That.
It's late in the day for me too, in a way. But what I'm really attracted to thinking about and writing about is contradictions that can't be reconciled. Yeah. Because this is really how I see the world. You're never going to have a cohesive view of something. You're always going to have varied opinions that clash with each other and are contingent on one another. So as far as writing the book, being a fan who's critical of it, that to me only makes sense.
Yeah.
Like I always make the analogy of, it's like a sibling, right? Like I'm allowed to make fun of my sister, but if someone else does, like, look out, you know?
Exactly.
You deeply love them, but you're also critical of them because you love them,
right,
you know?
Right.
So that is something that I think the way that I approach a lot of things, when I write journalism, sometimes not really. I mean, a lot of people think I'm just a hater, but a lot of times because I get assigned to review things that editors will know that I hate.
But I mean, there are specific critiques like you for Brain Candy. I mean, I remember watching on live television the At the Movies right. episode with Siskel and Ebert where they feuded.
Yes.
They feud over Brain Candy.
Ebert hated it. Down, Siskel
hated
thumbs
it.
Up.
Yeah, Siskel liked it. And
but I'll tell you this, we showed Brain Candy at the Royal for the book launch here. A couple hundred people came out and you know, my friends were there, but to support me, but like there were loads of strangers who were there to see Brain Candy.
It's a good,
and everyone was
good,
laughing along, you know? And it's the kind of thing, it sort of aged well.
Right, and you also mentioned John Doyle's review of for the Globe and Mail of Death Comes to Town, and I think you try to take an even-handed view of it, but you don't necessarily agree with him.
He
went off. He just was like, it's horrible.
Well, don't get me started. I don't want to talk about John Doyle right now necessarily. But it's funny because John Doyle's favorite show of the universe is Corner Gas, mm-hmm. and Death Comes to Town is essentially a raunchy parody of a Corner Gas style, like parochial Canadian sitcom.
I only raise these examples because it's true what you're saying. Like, as a fan, you can be critical of something you love, but when someone else is critical of it, the knives come out.
Yeah.
So you've done a really wonderful job of including critiques of the Kids in the Hall by others, by offering your own, and by also celebrating them for what they were, which I wrote a review of your book for the Globe and Mail, and I...
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I step back and I'm like, is this too much? Have I gone into some kind of hyperbolic light speed here or something? But I said some stuff about how, as much as they were compared to something like Monty Python,
mm-hmm.
I don't think there was anything like them. I really don't.
No. I mean, formally, they're so different from Python. I mean, I think there's sort of like, you could create a family tree that sort of goes, you know, Python, Kids in the Hall, Mr. Show, Tim and Eric, whatever.
Sure.
But again, this is something I really try to drive home in the book too, is to me, they were sort of, if you look at the history of comedy, the first time when comedy became for lack of a better word, cool. You know, my friend and I have a joke where it's like every time you reference a Monty Python sketch, you lose one sexual encounter from a lifetime allotment.
Sure, sure.
So,
right.
So I don't want to risk it by going any further. But it's like there's not that sort of level of nerdiness. Like now we talk about comedy nerds, but it's like anything being a nerd is cool now. But the kids in the hall were sort of jaded and disaffected and funny. And it was like, it feels cool.
They weren't lame.
Yeah. And SNL, yeah. You can be like, yeah, okay, those early casts were cool because they were just doing mountains of blow all the time. But that doesn't necessarily come across on screen when you're watching like the Bees.
Yeah, exactly. And also with SNL, I don't think certain seasons have aged well.
Yes. Whereas, I don't think much SNL has aged well.
No, because it's meant to be a very, it's a topical reflection of whatever's going on at the time of their tapings. Whereas I think I pointed this out in my review. I think one of the great, I mean, there's a couple of instances as we've mentioned, or as I mentioned earlier, where you think that's probably a dated thing to have done.
Right.
Actually, now that I think about it, I feel like the example that you mentioned was them lampooning the very notion of being politically incorrect. I'm trying to think of what
The screw you taxpayers sketch? Or no, Buddy Cole. The Buddy Cole stuff I write a bit about.
Buddy Cole stuff, but there's also a sketch, I think, where Bruce is playing
a Chinaman.
Yes.
Like sorry that I said Chinaman in quotes. But he's playing like a toothy.
But it seems self-aware.
But the point of that sketch was it opens with this really offensive sketch, and then Mark McKinney comes out. And that's one of my favorite sketches on the show. And says, wow, what an offensive sketch. But guess what? You just paid to see it. And then explains how the public funding structure of the CBC works.
Right.
And then keeps getting the audience to repeat the phrase, screw you, taxpayer.
That's right.
Which, I'm smiling now, like thinking about it. Like, it's still so funny to me.
Yeah,
especially because we live in this sort of Canadian culture now that's like so timid and reserved about doing anything that'll get like an angry letter that might like incite something.
But the kids overall, I think they didn't really do topical stuff.
No.
Like, and I think that serves them
and
their material well.
Yeah.
The show, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, Scott would do like, you know, Queen Elizabeth impressions.
Yes.
That's topical for the last like 60 years.
She seems like she's going to be around a while. It's never going to go out of style. Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, all this to say, I just, as a fan of them, I appreciate what you've done with this book.
Thank you.
I do wonder about one thing, at least one thing. You talk about the fact that most of these interviews were conducted with the kids in the hall, 3 years ago or something, when you were doing the oral history piece, or maybe some of them are even from before that. Have they commented on this book? Are they behind the book?
It's an unauthorized biography,
right,
if that's not clear. I think they have their own official book coming out in like 2 years, which I was talking to them about wanting to write. I don't know how boring this is going to sound. Paul Myers is writing, and Mike Myers'
brother.
Yeah,
I know Paul. Yeah.
Who wrote a book about the Bare Naked Ladies. And that's fine. I mean, some of them supported me writing it. Some of them, no answer. But like Scott sent me an email being like, I think it's great. There could be 20 books about the kids in the hall. You know, so I don't know if there's any like tension. In a way, I don't really care.
Have they mentioned the book in any context?
I think they're, I don't know what to say, like denying it or something. But it's like,
I tagged them. My reason is we tagged them when we wrote the review. And I saw that normally if Scott, like I've had Scott Thompson on this show, I've had Bruce McCullough on this show, and every time they've been on, they circulate it. You know, whoever does the Kids in the Hall stuff circulates it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think they're trying to sort of like focus on the
other
Paul
book.
Myers book.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is totally fine.
Okay. Sorry. Maybe this is too inside, but I was just curious if they were like, this is amazing. Thank you for doing this.
Well, I think that like they think that there are like skeletons in their closet that are going to be rattled out. And like, in a way, the idea of doing an official biography doesn't appeal to me, because all the things that you're talking about that you say you like about the book, even the tone, it's like something I don't think I'd be able to get away with. And I also, as a journalist, don't necessarily love this idea of giving the subjects like sign-off power.
And that's all well and good. That's the only thing I was wondering, because I thought it was odd that they were being silent about this, I think, really monumental contribution to their legacy.
Well, maybe they'll hear this and change their tune.
Maybe I'll write Scott a note. If anyone's going to do anything about it, it's Scott. Well, anyway, it's fantastic. I hope people check it out. This is a book about the kids in the hall.
That's right.
It's out on ECW Press. So what's next for you? What are you working on?
Well, I'm putting together a proposal right now for a second book that I'm hoping to get shopped around in the early winter.
Okay.
which I don't want to jinx.
No, 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 don't, you don't have to talk about it.
That'll be different than this.
Okay. More nonfiction or?
Nonfiction. Okay. Yeah. Okay. But this is like, maybe too early in my life to say, this is my magnum opus book that I've always wanted to write. But it's true.
Okay.
And I sent the proposal to my agent, and he's like, this is great. You just have to sort of change this, this, and this, and then we'll kind of get it out. So, again, I have a really bad habit of jinxing things. So I wish I could stop talking.
No, no, it's fine. Sorry, I just wondered if you had
But yeah, writing, you know, I'm in the Globe and Mail and Maclean's about every weekish.
Yeah.
This might interest you. I'm doing an interview with, do you know AJ Weberman?
Yes, of course.
So I'm going to profile AJ Weberman.
Really?
Which I'm very excited about. Because with all the Dylan stuff, for people listening who don't know, AJ Weberman is a sort of,
he's a miscreant, really. He's a troll. He was like one of the first real rock trolls.
But he sort of became famous or infamous by sifting through Bob Dylan's trash in the late 60s, early 70s.
Being attacked by Dylan on the street,
attacked by Dylan on the street and harassing him with various phone calls, which you can listen to on YouTube, which are hilarious.
I have a vinyl record of some of those
And
phone
writing
calls.
What I have here, I mean, obviously you're just listening to this, but the Dylan to English Dictionary
by AJ Weberman.
So these are people that I really like to talk to. And I think with the, you know, Dylan getting the Nobel, it's like, oh, Oxford poetry professor Christopher Ricks weighs in. It's like, no, I want to hear about the guy who is like going through Dylan's garbage and like has these YouTube videos. I won't even repeat the things he says about Dylan these days. Yeah. But this is basically a guy who's like, in 1971, like, Dylan, you've lost it.
I've kind of lost track of AJ Weberman, so it's interesting. Are you talking to him, did you say?
I spoke to him on the phone last week. Just to be like, he was fine. I was like, well, you know, would you agree to be... do a couple long form interviews. He's like, yeah, that's fine. He was, you know, very curt. But it should be interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's, who's that for?
Still, I don't want to say anything
right away. Shopping it around.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, and where can people learn more about you and the world of the internet?
I have a Squarespace. Uh-huh. Follow me on Twitter, I guess. I'm so annoying on Twitter.
You have a weird Twitter name.
John Semley 3000.
3000.
Yeah.
That's what I just couldn't remember.
Yeah.
John Semley 3000.
On Twitter, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess that's the best. If you want to know literally anything I think about anything.
Where can people get the book?
You can get the book on bookstores, mom and pop bookstore. Yeah. If they don't have it, you can order it in. Or you can always go on the internet, ECW's website. Amazon.
Yeah.
I always want to say Amazon last.
Yeah, you should have.
Yeah.
It's available. People can find
it. You can buy it wherever books are sold.
And Kids in the Hall fans should pick this thing up.
Kids in the Hall fans should pick it up. And also, I believe the CBC put all of the Kids in the Hall on their website for free.
Did they?
Yeah, so good occasion to get reacquainted.
Oh, good. Okay, I'm going to go home and watch all of that right now.
Bada bing. All right, Vishwa, thanks for talking to me.
Thank you so much
for
being on the show. And like I was saying, best of luck with everything going forward. And people should read this stupid book you wrote. It's not stupid. It was a bad way to end it.
I know what you mean.
It's great. Yeah. I've said it enough times. It's a fantastic book. Thank you, John.
Okay, thanks.
Hey, if you want to hear more of John Semley and I in conversation, you can, sort of. We are going to be appearing together on a panel. If you hear this in time, that is, you can join us live at the Polish Combatants Hall on Friday, December 2nd. This is part of Long Winter. I'm staging a version of my Long Night with Vish Khanna show. It's going to be a panel discussing 2016. We're going to review 2016. Great year. Fantastic year. Nothing bad happened this year. On the panel, besides John and myself, Freddie Rivas, comedian Freddie Rivas, Laura Hermiston of the band Twist, Jill Krajewski of Vice, and Aliyah Pabani of the Imposter podcast. So that's happening 7:30 at Long Winter, Friday, December 2nd. At the Polish Combatants Hall in Toronto, 206 Beverly Street. I like John so much after this conversation we had, I thought he would be an ideal candidate for the panel. So thanks, John, for being on the show and joining me on this panel. This is the 290th episode of Creative Control, and you can learn more about the show on my website, vishkhanna.com. It is available as a podcast on iTunes and audioboom.com. You can also go to patreon.com to make a flexible monthly donation to the podcast. We're also on Facebook. Like us on Facebook. Interact with us there. On Twitter, @VishCreative. And a version of the show airs every Wednesday at noon Eastern Standard Time at CFRU.ca around the world, or CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph and the surrounding area. The show would not be possible without some sponsors. The Bookshelf is an independently owned bookstore, bar, music venue, movie theater, and restaurant located at 41 Quebec Street in Guelph. More information about their hours, listings, blogs, directions, accessibility, and to order books from their online store from anywhere in the world, please visit bookshelf.ca. Also, Pizza Trocadero, the finest pizzeria in all of Guelph. They've got delicious gourmet pizzas, and you can make stuff. Like, they have the idea to make great pizzas, but you can also choose your own, do whatever you like. But I trust them. They know what they're doing. You can find them at 7 Municipal Street in Guelph or trocaderoguelph.ca. Call them at 519-829-2444. I think I had enough fours there. For pickup and delivery in Guelph, that's Pizza Trocadero, a place of the good trade. And I think that's all I'm going to say for now. John Semley, his book about the kids in the hall. You know, I went ahead and ordered the complete DVD box set off of eBay. Even though John mentions in the interview that you can watch all of the Kids in the Hall for free at cbc.ca, I still went ahead and got the DVDs. That's how much of an impact. And I've seen most of it. I mean, I'm a fan, but still, I don't have everything. So I ordered it. So I urge you to also go on. You can't get it easily. So if you want to get the complete series, go to cbc.ca to watch it. Or why am I plugging eBay? I don't know. All I'm saying is the Kids in the Hall are great. John's great. Thank you very much for listening. I'll talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.